previously on the history of Singapore. The British, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew, successfully crushed the left-wing anti-colonial nationalist movement and imprisoned their leaders without trial, and then fixed the constitutional agreement so that the left-wing leaders could not run in the next election. Obviously, the rest of the left-wing independence movement is not happy about this. And in particular, the PAP left-wing is furious with Lee Kuan Yew's right-wing adventurism and selfishness. A confrontation with Lee Kuan Yew and his followers over the heart and soul of the PAP is inevitable. Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, Episode 32, The Cardinals of the Kremlin. Throughout human history, one of our central preoccupations has been about how we, as human beings, should organize our societies for the greatest good. Over the centuries, consensus has moved towards mass participation in liberal democracy as the ideal. The creation of political parties within these liberal democratic systems is, in contrast, a much more recent invention. And likewise, the discussion of how to organize our political parties for the greatest good is also a much more recent discussion. The modern political party was formalized by the great Irish political leader Charles Stewart Parnell in the 1880s. So while democracy is as old as the ancient civilizations of Greece, the modern concepts of political parties are really only about 130 years old. But they have become an integral part of democracy. Today, if you aspire to win elections and form a government, you need to be a member of a political party. This is in spite of the fact that if you look at the constitutions of most, if not all, democracies around the world, none of them actually mention political parties. It's not part of the actual system, but it's become so assumed that we take it for granted that it has to be part of the system, that it has to be there. And how you run your party, how you organize your party, how you lead your party is very indicative of how you run your government and organize your government and lead your government. Indeed, if you want to see how well politicians will do in power, how they run their party when they're out of power gives you an indication. So the struggle for the heart and soul of the PAP that took place in the late 50s and early 60s was also a struggle for the heart and soul of Singapore's future government. And at its core was two different ideas about how Singapore should be governed, about how Singapore society should be organized, about the best way to organize a party and a government for the greatest good. Let's pick up where we left off the last time. It's important to remember that the British, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew alliance had two enemies. We always remember the PAP left wing. But there is another person who espoused the same values as them, who was also one of the most popular politicians in Singapore, David Marshall. During the Legislative Assembly debate over the 1957 constitutional agreement, which we were discussing in our last episode, David Marshall challenged anyone to a by-election contest over the issue, and Lee Kuan Yew promptly interrupted him to accept. And in the ensuing by-election, Lee Kuan Yew deliberately, totally misrepresented David Marshall's position. You see, Marshall, very typically for him, but of course, politically, very unwisely, spoke his mind freely. He spoke from a principled point of view. And he believed that process matters. How you do things matters. And where you draw your legitimacy from matters. If the Singapore government truly believed in the clause banning those detained for subversion from running in the 1959 elections, it should then pass it as a law through the normal political process. Marshall said he would not, could not object to such a law if it were passed by the elected representatives of the people of Singapore, as opposed to having it imposed by a foreign power. And so Lee Kuan Yew took this nuanced and principled position and twisted it into, oh, David Marshall is in favor of the subversives clause, and I am not. So can you believe the hypocrisy of Lee? He is the one who suggested and pushed for the subversives clause, and he lied about opposing it. And now he is not just campaigning as the person opposing the clause, but attacking Marshall as the champion of the subversives clause. He's such an utter amoral basket. Lee attacked the subversives clause, declaring, quote, "The fight is not over," unquote, and pledging to carry the fight, quote, "back to London when necessary," unquote. It's just amazing how hypocritical he is. But you see his political skill. He's maneuvered things into a position where he has created this clause which gets rid of his opponents, but publicly is seen as the number one enemy of the clause. So he's thoroughly outmaneuvered David Marshall in parliamentary politics. And David Marshall couldn't reply because David Marshall decided not to run in the by-election. Although many people, including 19 independent trade unions, came out in support of Marshall, he realized that he was on the wrong side of public opinion. He knew he was thoroughly outmaneuvered. And he wrote in his private diary that he believed a sustained campaign of resistance to the clause, to the agreement, would only lead to what he described as, quote unquote, dangerous disruption and possibly violence in Singapore. And Marshall abhorred violence and would rather step aside than see people hurt. But it's also possible Marshall had learned from his political experience. Remember, Marshall's first job in government, first job in politics of any form, was chief minister. And it was a real crash course, a real steep learning curve. And so Marshall now had learned. He's not stupid, he's just inexperienced. He had learned and he now realized that the era of direct and associational democracy that characterized 55, 56 was over. Because of the repression by the government, the associations and the activists who had supported him throughout his term as chief minister were now unable or too fearful to act. The repression had decisively ordained the Legislative Assembly as the sole arena of permissible political activity. And so David Marshall was a man without a party base and so had no way to operate effectively in the Legislative Assembly. He didn't have a political party. He had relied upon directly appealing to workers and students via the associations, the trade unions, but now he was adrift. And so he announced he would not contest the by-election and he stepped away from politics. It is one of the paradoxes of this PAP official narrative of history that David Marshall and the PAP left had almost the exact same outlook and the same political agenda, but are depicted as polar opposites. Both Marshall and the PAP left opposed the Internal Security Council and demanded its abolition. They demanded the release of political detainees. They wanted the independence of Singapore as soon as possible, either on its own or with the Federation of Malaya as an equal state. They wanted a socialist Singapore. But Marshall, if you read our official histories, is painted with adjectives like bold, principled, passionately anti-colonial, firmly anti-communist, with a firm commitment to liberal democratic values, who played by the rules. And yet at the same time, he's unrealistic, he's naive, inefficient, changes his mind too often. And yet at the same time, the same set of policies espoused by the PAP left, with a similar directness and boldness of action as principles, is declared to be evidence of their fanatical devotion to communism and their ruthless efficiency. So the history peddled by the PAP is full of flaws and contradictions like this. And this raises the question then, if they saw them saw things so similarly, why didn't David Marshall join forces with the PAP left? Well, you see, as a member of the professional class and a Jew and a man in his 40s, he was very far removed from the young trade unionists who made up the PAP left. And in particular, Marshall really did not know Chinese culture. He didn't understand Chinese, and he was very suspicious of the Chinese students and trade unionists who made up the base of the PAP left. He genuinely feared they were communists or being manipulated by them. He had no idea. So, having been schooled by Lee, right, Marshall decided not to contest the by-election, and so he would make two important choices following that. The first was that he embarked on a study tour of China to try and broaden his understanding of Chinese culture. The second was that he would try and start a genuine pro-labor political party because he believed none of the political parties in Singapore then adequately represented labor, and there were many who agreed with him. And so he was going to start his own political party to do it properly and build up a proper mass-based party with a proper organizational structure. And it would be called the Workers' Party. And it survives today. But that's a story for another time. With Marshall gone from the scene temporarily, Lim and Lee Kuan Yew turned their attention to removing the PAP left wing. At the founding of the PAP, the right-wing intelligentsia centered around Lee Kuan Yew ostensibly coexisted as equals with the left-wing trade union leadership centered around Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair. The right-wing intelligentsia provided legal expertise and political representation. The trade union leaders provided organizational and moral leadership and a connection to the public, the organizational base. But both provided equal amounts of intellectual leadership, political leadership. However, as the trade unions and other anti-colonial associations made the early running on political progress throughout 1955 and 56, and also being far, far bigger than the right wing, the left wing held the political initiative and dominated party activity. Lee Kuan Yew chafed at the trade union's dominance and worked hard to undermine it. He was convinced he had to be the one in charge. He believed in rule by one man who took all the decisions, not by popular debate and discussion. Once democratic associationalism had been repressed by Lim Yew Hock in 57, the Legislative Assembly became the sole arena where political activity was permitted, and this shifted the initiative to politicians like Lee Kuan Yew. With the Labour Front having destroyed its popular support, the PAP was the sole major centre-left party still enjoying popular anti-colonial legitimacy. Within the party, members became increasingly convinced that they were the favourites for the next election. It was theirs to win or lose. Influence in the PAP would correspond to influence in the next government, and this raised the stakes. The left-wing leaders like Chin Siong and Devan had successfully stood for election to the party Central Executive Committee in 1956 to restrain Lee Kuan Yew's right-wing adventurism, but they were now detained. Without the left-wing leaders in attendance in the CEC could just ignore the party branches and act without consultation or ratification. Secure in the control of the PAP, they were free to ignore the trade unionists' progressive principles or the workers' interests. And in his public speeches in this time, if you read them, you see Lee very carefully triangulating. He maintains this ideological distance from the progressive left, even while denouncing the government. For example, when the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance, that's the law which permits detention without trial and under which all the PAP left-wing leaders had been detained, when the PPSO came up for renewal, Lee Kuan Yew carefully contorted himself into a position that enabled him to say that he was on both sides of the argument. So, in the Legislative Assembly, he said he was in favor of the law, that it was necessary because of the importance of keeping the Federation of Malaya happy to enable reunification and merger. But then he said he was against the law because it was in the hands of unelected officials. He then voted against its extension. And it was pretty transparent to those in the Legislative Assembly at the time. In his response, Lim Yew Hock, his speech responding to Lee, Lim Yew Hock parodied Lee, saying, quote, "This law is all right if we operate it. This law is not all right because the other side is operating it. We will support any such law because the situation in the Federation demands it. But we cannot support it now because it is still a semi-colonial administration that is running it." Unquote. And Lee Kuan Yew replied, "It is true." So the PAP left wing were sick of Lee Kuan Yew's shenanigans. The party membership knew that Lee was talented and capable, but he was also following his own agenda that conflicted with the parties and with the party memberships. He shadow boxed with himself over the PBSO. He sabotaged the 1956 London talks, offered only a limp defense of the left after the repression of late 1956, early 1957, implicitly agreed that the PAP left were communists, endorsed the continued colonial control of internal security in the 1957 talks, supported the postponement of the 1957 elections. He and Tan Wee Tiong had not played a significant role in legally representing those detained in the 1956 round of arrests, leaving that to T.T. Rajah. The great Samat Ismail, who had done more than anyone to promote the PAP among Malay Singaporeans, was furious at Lee and had consequently resigned from the PAP. So the PAP left wing needed to control Lee Kuan Yew. The question arises, well, why not fire him? And there's several reasons for that. The first is that he was the undisputed leader of the party in the Legislative Assembly. When politics is limited to the Legislative Assembly, you need your best weapons. You need the people who know best how to operate in the Assembly. And he was by far the best. His skill was undeniable. His ability as a politician was undeniable. And with Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair behind bars, Lee was really the only other very capable politician the PAP had. No one wanted to throw him away just because he had his own agenda. You know, we recognize in a political system, politicians have their own agendas, right? Everyone has their own agenda. They just wanted to make sure he would obey the rules of the PAP, rules which he himself had helped write. So an analogy might be Deputy Prime Minister Tharman Shanmugaratnam, right? Modern day DPM Tharman. He clearly has an agenda and a perspective that differs from the PAP's hardcore. But he's also the most popular and capable and talented politician. So you don't throw him away. What you do is you make sure you can control him. You make sure that he accepts party discipline. You use his talents for your benefit. He is a tool you can use, a weapon that you can use. And secondly, and more importantly, the PAP left wing believed that infighting would fatally undermine the anti-colonial movement. Unity was paramount if they were going to kick the colonials out. Anti-colonialism first. Once we get rid of the British, then we are free to disagree amongst ourselves as an independent country. But decolonization first. So the PAP had to rein in their dissident Lee Kuan Yew and his faction. But how? Join us when we return. The PAP had a problem. They had a wayward leader, Lee Kuan Yew, who kept ignoring party interests and rules to pursue his own agenda. Under his leadership, the PAP Central Executive Committee were openly flouting party rules. Resolutions by branches were not even being dignified with a negative reply. The publication of the PAP's Action Express newsletter had been stopped with no explanation. Members had been ordered not to distribute pamphlets on May Day, unlike previous years. When party member Chua Ah Leong was arrested, there was no protest from the CEC. The CEC refused to run the branch's nominee, Goh Kong Beng, in the Cairnhill by-election. There was no consideration of the policies such as a united national government or a push for early elections, despite the party membership being heavily in favor of both. And perhaps most importantly, there was no debate over the crucial issue of whether independence would be achieved via a merger of the Federation or of independence would precede merger. All this flouting of the rules emanated from the man at the top. Lee Kuan Yew had to accept rule by law. They had to rein him in, control him, make him accept party discipline. But how? Well, with associational democracy virtually banned and the Anti-Yellow Cultural Council dissolved, see episode 30, PAP members set up a central education and cultural committee, as well as committees in all the branches, to bring the former associational activity into the political party. And on 30th of June 1957, a joint meeting of the Central Education and Cultural Committee and its branch counterparts heavily criticized the Central Executive Committee. But the members of the Education and Cultural Committee were divided over how to proceed. Some wanted to remove Lee from power. Others wanted to leave the PAP and establish a new People's Front Party. But the leaders of the Education and Cultural Committee, including Tan Kong Guan and Goh Boon To, who were chair and vice chair of the Central Education and Cultural Committee, respectively, advocated unity. They argued that they should restore their voice onto the CEC by electing left-wing representatives at the party's upcoming annual conference in August 1957. As a compromise, they agreed they would also draft the constitution for a new party. If they failed to win sufficient representation on the CEC, they would leave and form a new party. At the same time, the right-wing PAP leadership was also plotting. They wanted to change the rules to permanently end the influence of the party's membership and to ensure their unchallenged grip on power. Lee Kuan Yew believed that the party was his vehicle. He was not a person to be elected by the party membership. The party was his to use as he saw fit. If there was internal party democracy, he would be slowed down by things like accountability and transparency. He would have to be responsible for his own actions. And he couldn't have that. He didn't want that. So he and Toh Chin Chai came up with a plan. To disguise their intentions, they introduced a motion at the party conference to add the words non-communist to the party's policy aim. In other words, quote, an independent, democratic, non-communist, socialist Malaya, unquote. Buried in the motion was a direction to the Central Executive Committee to reorganize the party and amend its constitution. Once people voted for the motion, they could then use this obscure clause in the motion to then reorganize the party to remove internal party democracy. And so, although no one knew it at the time, the party conference of the 4th of August was thus a showdown, a battle for the future direction of the PAP. Lee Kuan Yew's group easily succeeded in their goal. The repudiation of communism and the hidden clause was enthusiastically passed 1,150 to 112. The party left were also successful. In the election, Lee and five of his allies were re-elected. At the same time, the Labour leaders, who wanted to work more closely with Lee, won the six other seats in the CEC. And so the result was both an endorsement of Lee and of the left-wing leaders who wanted to work with Lee, act as a check on Lee. Now, publicly, the conference passed without a stir. In contrast to the machinations of the Labour Front's annual conferences, the PAP's internal politics seemed unremarkable. It was well known there were tensions within the party, but these were differences in opinion. You know, they're typical of any large organization. And so the press looked at the result as routine turnover. But then, to widespread surprise, Lee Kuan Yew's group resigned from the party's leadership post. Lee resigned as Secretary General, Toh Chin Chai as chairman. And the left-wing leaders in the CEC were flummoxed because they had run on a platform of working with Lee, but now he refused to work with them. So Ong Chai An, one of the Labour leaders, offered to resign from the CEC in favour of a Lee nominee if Lee Kuan Yew stayed on as Secretary General, but Lee Kuan Yew refused. And so the left wing decided, oh, well, okay, I guess we'll have to run the party. So Tan Chong Kim became chairman and T.T. Raja became secretary general. In May, before the party conference, Lim Yew Hock, quote, quote, expressed the view that a second large-scale attack on subversive elements may be necessary in July or August, unquote. And so now he looked at the PAP and he saw it in control of the left, and he couldn't have that. The left would be a major threat to him. So he now sought to take action. Governor Robert Black, British Commissioner Nigel Morris, Special Branch Director Alan Blades, and Special Branch Assistant Director Kokai Bo all objected to this. They pointed out that given recent events, such an action would be seen as politically motivated and designed to assist Lee Kuan Yew to pull his chestnuts out of the fire by eliminating his opposition within the PAP. But Lim Yew Hock assured them this was a move for the greater good. He said Lee had begged Lim to save him by taking this action, and Lim said he would take full responsibility for it, and then a grateful Lee would then be indebted to him. And Lim hinted to Robert Black that it would lead to the right-wing coalition desired by the British. The British, you see, were very keen on a coalition between Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew. And in fact, one Colonial Office civil servant wrote in a memo, quote, "We see in such an association the best hope of some stable political structure emerging in Singapore," unquote. Governor Black also suggested that, quote, "Another reason for hesitation on the part of the police officers might relate to the amount of evidence which they could produce quickly to satisfy counsel and appeal and the appeal tribunal," unquote. Black noted that Lim, quote, "acknowledged that in some respects this evidence might be thinner than it had been in the cases of men whom we detained last year, but he was satisfied it would be convincing," unquote. Well, Lim Yew Hock told him, don't worry. He would find the evidence. And so, based on Lim's instructions, Special Branch assembled a case for arrest. Once again, a picture was painted of a broad MCP conspiracy. That's a Malayan Communist Party conspiracy. If you read Special Branch reports, they originally report certain activities as isolated groups of diehard posers who were just trying to pretend they were communists. And suddenly, after Lim Yew Hock's instructions, these same isolated groups are suddenly reinterpreted as secret cells of widespread conspiracy, widespread organization. Sunday picnics at remote beaches held by trade unions were called a typical example of communist front activities, despite picnics being widely held by all organizations, including UMNO Singapore or the government-linked unions, because this was a cost-efficient social activity. This is 1957. What other cheap activity do you have for, you know, an office excursion? You go on a picnic. Then the Cultural and Educational Committee of the PAP was declared, quote, "one of typical Chinese communist pattern, which is quite clearly designed for further subversion," unquote. It's a committee. Everyone works by committees. The civil service is full of committees. Then attempts to revive trade union activity against the increased encroachment by employers on workers' rights were called, quote, "maneuvering to gain control in important and typical communist fields of activity," unquote. You know, it's a deliberate interpretation simply to support the special decision that Lim Yew Hock and the Special Branch had already made. A new twist was to automatically consider any activity by former members of dissolved organizations as communist front activity. So, having been a victim of repression, having been detained, having been part of an organization that was dissolved, you know, you could have been completely innocent, but suddenly the fact that you went through that repression is now evidence that could be used to excuse further repression. Think of it this way, okay? And this is going to be a bit shocking, but this is, I think, an appropriate analogy. You rape a woman. Then you say, well, she got raped, so she must be a slut. So if she's a slut, then it's okay for you to rape her again. You see, this is the sick, twisted logic that Special Branch used to justify detaining and torturing people a second time by saying that they had been detained and tortured already, so that is evidence that they are communists and therefore we can do it to them again. The British were very worried about such blatantly opportunistic detentions. And William Goode wrote, "I am uneasy about the timing in relation to PAP affairs." Unquote. The security liaison officer, the MI5 man in Singapore, Russell Jones, recommended deferring arrests until after the Federation's independence on 31st August. Lim Yew Hock replied to both William Goode and Russell Jones that he and Lee Kuan Yew were determined to go forward with attacking the left from without and within the PAP. And again, he talked up the possibility, dangled this possibility of him and Lee Kuan Yew working in government together, which was what the British wanted. And Tunku Abdul Rahman also expressed favour for early action. So Operation Apple was carried out in the early morning of 23rd August. 18 PAP members, including 5 CEC members, 13 trade unionists and 4 Sin Pao journalists were arrested. The Sin Pao was shut down. And in the Legislative Assembly, Colonial Secretary William Goode tabled a white paper called The Communist Threat in Singapore. Lee Kuan Yew once again barely offered a defence. He argued that first, the arrest was self-serving for the Labour Front government. Second, he agreed that the PAP left were communists, but said, quote, "We in the PAP are quite capable of looking after ourselves," unquote. So in other words, what he's saying is, yes, these people are communists. Yes, you should detain them. But no, you shouldn't detain them because they're our communists. We will take care of it. Working both sides of the issue as usual. And a fearful public, after all these arrests, for almost a year now, arrests, 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 they were limited to sullen complaints with the usual comments about democracy, the need for justice and transparency, and the legality of the arrest. The unions decided not to hold any mass meetings as it would lead to clashes with the police and lead to violence, and limited themselves to demanding, yet again, demanding the trial or release of their arrested members. And the problem was also, of course, that their leaders were behind bars. They were rudderless. On Sunday, 20th October 1957, a special PAP party conference elected a new CAC. It was done on a slate. They simply put up 12 members, up or down. When Lee Kuan Yew commenced speaking, around 100 members out of 700 present got up and just walked out in protest about how the election was being conducted. Lee and Toh Chin Chai then rewrote the party constitution to ensure that they had total control. All party members were directed to re-register, and prominent members of the left, anyone that Lee Kuan Yew didn't like, was refused registration of the party. Voting rights within the party were limited to a new class of cadre members who would be chosen only by the CEC. The origin of this structure is disputed. Lee Kuan Yew says he came up with the idea on a visit to Vatican City. Toh Chin Chai says it was his idea, his suggestion, also from the Vatican. But I think there's also another influence which neither man wanted to admit, an influence much closer at hand, and that is the Malayan Communist Party. Remember, at this point, the MCP still remains this feared mythical opponent. Even Special Branch, for all the evidence that they had that the MCP is broken and dysfunctional in Singapore, won't believe their own evidence and remain convinced that somewhere out there the MCP is plotting, plotting, plotting to destroy them all. And likewise, there's no doubt that Lee Kuan Yew and Toh Chin Chai are scared of this myth of the PAP. And Lee Kuan Yew gives this away in his own autobiography when he says that he was learning from the communists and adopting and adapting communist techniques in how he ran the PAP. And one of the examples he cites in his autobiography is that he learned to fix the outcomes of meetings beforehand. Another, probably, was to fix the leadership of the party to ensure complete control. And this is part of the reason, I think, is why he adopts the language of communism and calls the inner circle cadre members. It's a combination of the cardinals and the Kremlin. And this is an action which would presage Singapore's own future, because the conflict between Lee and the PAP left was not just about the party, it was not about the People's Action Party, it was about the future of Singapore. It's not just about how you organize and run a party, it was also about how you would then organize and run a government. Do you believe in debate, constructive criticism, working by consensus and committee, in transparency and accountability and democracy? Do you believe in compromise? Or do you believe in authoritarianism, in the enlightened despot, in one man imposing his will on the people without checks and balances and accountability for his mistake? That was really what this conflict was about. And we can see how it happened twice. First, in the PAP in these fateful events of 1957, once Lee's rivals were arrested and he had unchallenged control, he rewrote the party constitution to ensure that he had total control and could never lose, no matter how wrong or misguided he was. And then likewise, in the government of Singapore, after independence, once Lee's rivals were arrested and he had unchallenged control, he would rewrite the Singapore constitution to ensure that he had total control and could never lose, no matter how wrong or misguided he was. And perhaps you can make the argument that Lee has been overall a positive force for Singapore. That's a debate we will probably have till the end of time. But the fact is, you cannot make that same argument about his successors, who have made serious mistakes that could have been avoided through proper oversight and checks and balances. And eventually, some idiot will take the reins of power and we will not be able to challenge them, no matter how wrong or misguided they are. And this is the system that Lee has imposed on Singapore, to Singapore's detriment. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.